from WDEV in Waterbury. It's Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis. Thanks for joining us. It's Friday, April 12th. I hope you have survived the eclipse and the path of totality. Just so you know, my experience was less than inspirational. No special glasses, no parties. I was more focused on the break in the weather and storing away all my winter stuff. You know how that goes. The boots, the jackets, the winter socks, the gloves, all that stuff in your mudroom that spills out everywhere and can make a mess. Now it can go into a tub from Walmart and go into the barn. Suddenly your place seems lighter and cleaner. That is, of course, until the dirt from the garden shoes makes its way into the house with ticks, mud, tools, hats. But I digress. Today on the show, we review the week's top stories. Senator Dick Mazza resigns, an arrest in the Bernie Sanders fire case, Goddard College is for sale, and so much more. We'll break it down with Burlington political analyst Joanna Grossman. We are going to do something a little different at 10 a.m. today. We'll stay with the week's news in review because our political analyst from D.C., Bob Ney, is taking a little time off. So we're going to take your calls at 10 a.m. 244-1777. We'd love to hear from you. I heard in that CBS news break that we're there. I mean, when David Martin from CBS News comes on the line, the guy's been doing the Pentagon since, I was a young newspaper reporter in the 80s. So when he says it, you can take it to the bank. And he is saying that Iran is planning an attack on Israel. So that is going to cloud everything we do today. We'll stay up on the news as best we can. At 10:15, 7 Days reporter Kevin McCallum is going to join us to talk about the resignation of longtime Vermont Senator Dick Mazza. As I said, I've known Mazza for, 25 years or so. Kevin digs into the story deeper because it has all sorts of implications, both personal for Senator Mazza, his friends in the legislature and all over Vermont, but also politically and for the future of the Vermont legislature. And at 10:30, a real treat. 45 years ago, at the Savoy Theater in Montpelier, proprietor Rick Winston showed a film called Return of the Secaucus Seven. Now, those of you over the age of 65 or so are going to remember that film. Call it The Big Chill, but 4 years before it, and the budget was a lot less. Destined to be an underground hit that defined a generation. Well, Rick Winston's going to be here with us at 10:30, and he will be joined by one of the stars of the film. Can't wait for that. They filmed it for about $40,000, and they did it in a little ski lodge in North Conway, New Hampshire, back when you could do things like that. Again, we take your calls at 244-1777. Try to hold off on your calls till about 10 a.m., and we'll get to all of them. 244-1777. You can email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. But right now, let's turn to the week's news. And for that, we welcome in our semi-regular political analyst and commentator, Joanna Grossman. Hey there.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
I'm pretty good. So let's get right to it. And just for fun, I want to, you Burlington types, I want to throw a Central Vermont story at you, which you probably know nothing about, but it turns out that Goddard College is insolvent and for sale. It may seem like a small thing to a lot of people, but in Central Vermont, the people who went to school there, the people who worked there, and I'm talking people like the playwright David Mamet, the Hollywood actor William H. Macy, the architect Dave Sellers, Montpelier's own or Marshfield's own bread maker, Jules Rabin, the Bread and Puppet Theater. I mean, it is the end of something huge. And I know you, Joanna, as a New Yorker, there's always been, and I want to do a whole show on this someday, there's always been kind of an intellectual pipeline between New York City and Goddard College from way back in the 60s and 70s. Anyway, It's for sale. It's closing down. No more classes. I'm not sure any of us know what to make of it yet.
Oh, yeah, it's awful. I read that roughly 90 jobs are going to be eliminated. And no, it does seem real tragic. I don't have a personal connection to Goddard like so many Vermonters do. But I know, you know, I could see from social media so many people were sad and hurt about it. I was really kind of stunned about how something like that could even come to be. UVM has record enrollment and Goddard's enrollment just seemed to be sinking. I don't know how that happens, but it's definitely sad. I saw that there's, you know, they're trying to create an option for current students to transfer to a college in Arizona. And I kind of thought, how many Vermont college students are going to go to Arizona? It's just tragic.
Even though it's Prescott College, which is sort of a outdoors hiking, rock climbing college in Arizona. But yeah, the Goddard thing, I did some consulting work for Goddard a long time ago. The issue has always been enrollment, and it just seems to me it's following this course of higher education where the rich are going to do really well and the poor are not going to do well. So the UVMs and the Harvards are going to continue to do well, but the under the radar colleges like Goddard, Vermont College of Fine Arts in Montpelier, which has gone through and is going through the same thing. They just can't get students. You know, it's hard to justify paying. I just saw Harvard is approaching $100,000 a year. And, you know,
wow.
normal people can't do that anymore.
Yeah, true that.
Yeah. Okay. Issue number two, Senator Mazza. So,
yeah.
Dick Mazza has cancer. Let's be clear-eyed about that. There was a 7 days piece. Digger's written about it. As I said, I've known Senator Mazza for 25 years. He's been the chair of the – first of all, he served in the House. His father served in the legislature. He has been the chair of the Senate Transportation Committee for, 20 years. He is – a moderate Democrat who has become a kind of backroom advisor to all manner of politicians, be it Howard Dean, Dick Snelling, Jim Douglas, Phil Scott. He has been Phil Scott's mentor. When Phil Scott became a senator, he made it a point, and I think the governor has said this, he made it a point to ask to serve on the two committees that Mazza served on, transportation and institutions. And he and Mazza became kind of a tag team. So why don't we, I mean, obviously, let's talk first about, this is a really sad thing. Dick Mazza is a grocer in Colchester and Mallets Bay, and he's got cancer. And his resignation means that he's leaving the legislature and he's getting his affairs in order. And I feel terrible for him and his family.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's heartbreaking. He is truly like an institution. He's like Vermont's sort of classic, like, you know, old timey political leader. I mean, everybody seems to know him. And there's quite a tradition among campaigns to have to go to Mazza's grocery and meet him in the back room and kiss the ring, so to speak. I've been there with several candidates watching him pack grapes with his NRA stickers on the wall and you know, try to get his support. He's a very nice guy. You know, ever since that, I've been in touch with him now and then. And yeah, he's just sort of our classic Vermont politician and leader. And it is real. It's a real change. And it also creates significant openings in the legislature, too. The vultures are certainly circling and have been for a while.
So you say you've been in that back room, and so have I. So let's describe it for listeners for fun. I think Dick would enjoy this.
Yeah.
He's a collector of rare cars. And we've both been in that back room. So why don't you go ahead and describe what it means for you to take one of your clients or political allies to see Mazza?
Yeah, it's always been candidates and, you know, obviously you've got to try to arrange it ahead of time, make sure he's there and it's just like it's old Vermont General Store kind of thing, and you meet him in the back, and it's a real grocery back room. And like the last time that I can remember, and the time I was there the longest, he had a shipment of grapes, and he was, you know, packing them individually and weighing them out, like, while we're talking. And he, you know, he wanted to know my candidate's positions, but also, you know, really get a sense of their judgment and their vibe. And yeah, it's just, I mean, it was like, you know, this old, I feel like I'm not describing it that well, but this like very old, if you think of like Vermont General Store in your head, like you are picturing Mazza's store. It is the classic for real.
Yeah. But there's this subtle mixture, and I mean this in a positive way, us being political junkies, some might take it negatively. There's an aspect to it that is old school Brooklyn political machine.
Oh yeah.
As you say, it's in the back room. You're kissing the ring of a guy who can, with about three conversation, make things happen in Montpelier.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. It is like, he is like the closest thing to like a boss, a political boss, for sure.
Yeah, I remember taking the mayor of Burlington, Peter Clavel, to see him because we were trying to get the legislature to appropriate the money to allow Burlington to build what was then Filene's Basement, now a shuttered Macy's, now a high school. Because back then it was the progressive ideal of sort of downtown redevelopment. And we had to go talk to Mazza because we needed him to support the project.
Yep. His support is pretty handy. There's no question.
Yeah. And governors from Madeline Cunin to Howard Dean to Jim Douglas to Phil Scott, he's sort of a, you know, he's what's the word? It's not a litmus test, but he is the barometer of moderate, of where Vermont, of where what governors think of as regular Vermonters. He's the barometer of where those moderates would be. But now let's go to the politics of this, because that may be changing.
You know what? Before we pivot, I actually want to like make a little note. There's a term in Vermont, like real Vermonter, you hear now and then, and I try not to use that on my campaigns because I feel like if you live in Vermont, you're a real Vermonter. But I do kind of think he does embody whatever that is for a lot of people.
Now let's pivot, Joanna, to the politics of this. Mazza serves on something called, and we welcome listeners to go down the rabbit hole with us on Political Junkie Minute here. Mazza serves on something called the Committee on Committees, which is a three-member group comprised of the lieutenant governor, the president of the Senate, and then a third member that's chosen. And those three people decide who serves on which committees in the Vermont Senate. And that slot is now open.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I've definitely, you know, heard people chattering a little about it, not a ton, but that's a major, major, I mean, both of those, the chair of transportation and the committee on committees are both major openings.
Yeah, now longtime senator from Danville, Caledonia County, Jane Kitchell, the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, has written her colleagues in an email saying she wants the slot. And
right.
If you were making up a person, if you were writing it down on paper, someone who is similar to Mazza in terms of being conscientious and moderate, it would be Kitchell, and I can't believe they won't give her the slot.
Is that a lock that I hadn't heard? I definitely heard she was interested, but I hadn't heard that it was a hard no.
You know, I don't know the inside politics of it. I suspect that there might be other pretenders, but I'm not sure. I remember when 2 years ago there was some talk of, you know, wow, are we really going to have an all-male committee on committees here? Isn't it time that that there be at least one woman on that committee? And Kitchell fits the bill. She knows the budget inside and out. She's very good at the politics. She's highly respected and can work with the governor, which is a big deal.
Yeah, and she's super policy oriented. Like, I think she'd be a really good candidate. Not, you know, different people in the Senate bring different things, and she definitely could do the job.
Yeah. She also brings lunch for her committee every morning that she makes from scratch, which I still, whenever I see her, I ask her, like, really, how do you actually do that? I think she gets up really early. Another, the Senate Transportation Committee will need a new chair. Again, let's go down the rabbit hole. It's really boring, but there's millions and millions of dollars that flow through that committee in terms of the building of bridges and roads and the paving of roads. And Mazza was in charge of that and making sure that sort of what project got funded first and what project didn't. So that's looking for a new chair. My candidate is one of my senators, Washington Senator Andrew Perchlick, but I don't know if there are other pretenders for that post. Perchlick would be a natural.
Yeah, I think he would be a good choice. I mean, I'm just looking at the list, and I mean, I don't know who has actually expressed interest, but I know Tom Chittenden is very ambitious.
Yeah, so that's a great point. Tom Chittenden being the great grandson of the first governor of Vermont, great something.
Something like that.
Moderate. Yeah. I'm going to bet on Perchlick just because he's been at Mazza's elbow in a Phil Scott kind of way for quite some time now. And he's smart. He's a friend of Kitchell's on the Appropriations Committee. And
so it's my senator against yours, Kevin.
Oh, there you go. So can we talk about what the resignation of Senator Mazza means to the overall Senate? You know, for years we've been seeing a change in that body and the old guard. I'm thinking of Dick Sears, Dick Mazza, Ann Cummings, Jane Kitchell, Ginny Lyons from Chittenden County. Committee chairs, very powerful. They are no longer young, and the Senate is gradually being taken over by a youth movement, and Senator Mazza's resignation is another step in that direction.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a bunch of names, you know, being floated already for that position, both from Grand Isle and from Chittenden County. So it'll be interesting to see who bubbles to the top. I mean, the Senate does definitely have a reputation for being a little stodgy. There's no question about that. And then, you know, last session, we did have all these new members come in, which was really exciting. And I was like, oh, I can't wait to see what they do. But I actually don't think functionally it's changed much. Like, I do kind of feel like a lot of like stuff comes out of the House and it gets stopped in the Senate. And maybe that will always be the case. But I've been a little, I don't know if disappointed is exactly the right word, but a little surprised that there hasn't been more change in the Senate. But, you know, Mazza will be another seat, and there's not a ton of seats in the Senate, so maybe it will mean real change.
Yeah, and the governor, last piece on this, the governor is, I don't know if it's his policy, but it's certainly been his practice to, when there is a resignation, to appoint someone of similar temperament and of the same party. This isn't like New York or Texas, where the governor might use this as an opportunity to appoint a Republican.
Right.
So we'll see.
Yeah, and he actually has two seats to fill right now. He's got Emma Mulvaney Stanek's seat on the House side and then Mazza on the Senate side.
Oh, so give us the inside dope. Who's he going to appoint to replace Emma Mulvaney Stanek, who is now the mayor of Burlington?
I don't know who, but I do know that both the Progressive Party and the Democratic Party were asked to submit three names. Those three names were submitted. And, yeah, now it's a waiting game. He doesn't have to pick someone from those lists, or he could wait as long as humanly possible. We'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think she knows more than what she's saying. Grossman knows everything going on in Burlington, and she's got a name at the top of her list.
I wish I did know. I honestly, I mean, I know the names that were submitted by the Democrats. I have to actually pull it up for you, but I know one of them was Abby Duke, who is the owner of Sugar Snap, and I think she would be a great choice. I'm not sure who the other two were. I'd have to look back and check.
Okay. Joanna, let's talk about Bernie Sanders and the gentleman who is accused of and is in custody for spraying accelerant on the office door of Bernie Sanders' office on Church Street and then lighting it on fire. Why don't we go over what we know? What's the latest?
Yeah, sounds good. Sorry, can you hear me, Kevin? I just had a slight little issue with my audio.
You sound great.
Yeah, I mean, that's been unreal. I heard from someone connected with the investigation that there's actually been people trying to get into the office using ladders for weeks, and this was sort of the final thing. Someone tried to light it. They actually, sprayed an accelerant on his door and then tried to light a fire, and people were actually trapped inside. Everybody was okay, but it's pretty scary and unsettling. I know a lot of the electeds in Burlington had been receiving all kinds of threats for a while now. And, you know, it's just scary.
There's a couple of things about this story that stand out for me. Number one, he was caught on video. He was then caught by federal authorities, it wasn't the next day. It might have taken them 2 days to track him down at a local motel on Williston Road. It seems to me he made virtually no attempt to evade authorities. And now we're learning that he's had weapons in his possession in the past, and he's been on police radar in the past as well. But do you know? In my reading, I haven't found anything. Do you know, is there any motive for this? Do you any idea why he did this?
Not that I know of. I know that he was, like you said, he was actually found with an AK-47, not here in Vermont, but that had happened recently. And people I know connected with the investigation have also not seen any sign of motive yet. I don't know. It'll be good to know.
I mean, you can't help but speculate that, you know, Bernie Sanders has two things. He's been very visible about his position on Israel and Hamas, very critical of the Netanyahu government. That's number one. Number two, he was just recently online with Joe Biden doing a kind of playful video about criticizing Donald Trump for all sorts of reasons. And he, you know, Bernie Sanders standing next to an old line Democrat like Joe Biden for a video is interesting. It raised my eyebrow. You know, Bernie's he's always supported people like Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, but he's kind of kept his distance. Now he's in a video with Biden, which tells me that the Biden people are really nervous about the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And I'm just not used to seeing Bernie do those kinds of things.
Yeah, and also Jane was at the Jane Sanders was at the Jane Stetson event for the Biden Victory Fund. You're not wrong. I wonder if Bernie doesn't want to be remembered as contributing to Trump being reelected.
Right, and so now I spoke to someone really close to the Sanders community as well, and that person told me that increasingly, and I've been talking about this for a long time, this violence in our political system, people who are serving in government are less and less willing to tell people where they work and who they work for, whether it's at the doctor's office or at a restaurant or wherever. And, you know, if people working for Bernie Sanders are being reluctant to tell people who they work for, that is really chilling.
Yeah, I think that's a really astute observation. I mean, I feel like that too often, you know, like when I'm, and it gets harder and harder. Like, you know, when I'm running a campaign, I want to be like telling everybody, like, vote for so-and-so. But then, you know, you do get a little bit more self-conscious about it in this, you know, vitriolic environment. Like, you want to be doing good work and you don't want to be getting hate for it.
Yeah. You know, we have a caller on the line, and Lee Cattell on the soundboard just reminded me. So let's take it. Mark in Bristol, you are on the line with Joanna Grossman and Kevin Ellis.
Hey, so great to be with you folks. Well, you know, in the review of the week, you know, talking about property taxes, I'm just really concerned and been trying to figure out how the hell are the old school Vermonters who've been here forever. Hello?
Yeah, we got
we hear you.
Hello?
Mark in Bristol, we can hear you loud and clear. Okay, we lost him. I think we're going to go to the next call, which I think was Charlotte. Go ahead.
Oh, hi.
Okay.
This is Michelle.
Hi.
Michelle from – hi. So I wanted to make two comments. One is there's a wonderful book by James Gilligan called Violence, and in it he makes the case that a lot of – people like this man who lives in a motel, who tried to get into Bernie's office, they want to go to jail. In jail, everything's taken care of. You get your meals, you know what to do, and you look like a big, tough guy because you did this bad thing. So no one will ever know that you are a sad sack. And I think that's true of a lot of these kind of these lost guys who are doing this current violence, that they're lost in modern life. And if they get they can do something really violent and get to jail, then it's all taken care of. All their shame about being a lost soul and not no one wants to marry them, et cetera, it's all gone. So that's my comment.
Michelle, thank you. Joanna, what do you think of that?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. I mean, I do think that anyone who resorts to that is probably lost. I think that's probably an astute observation. The rest of it I'm really not sure about, but, you know, I don't know. I just think it's tragic.
Yeah. It's, you know, Michelle, you raise, for me, as a male, a really interesting point, and I think you're onto something there. These young men with their phones and their internet and all that goes with that, I think we're going to find after the studies are all done that these guys are lonely. They can't find a mate, a partner, and they resort to doing all sorts of crazy behavior. And I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. So there's a topic for a full show. I think we got Mark from Bristol back on the line. Mark, you were talking about property taxes, which was the next issue we were going to deal with, but you go ahead.
All right. Well, I think I've got a solution. Ha ha. California has Proposition 13 that was passed in 1978, and where whatever you paid for your property, you will always pay the tax rate on the original price that you paid. Now, let's say some of these old school Vermonters paid $60,000 for their house years ago. They would pay whatever the property tax rate is on $60,000, and as the property tax rate goes up, that's what you pay. And this way here, you know, they can pass on their generational wealth. All these struggling Vermonters who have this property but are getting taxed out of it with property taxes. Now, I'd love to see Joanne or somebody in the legislature to look at Proposition 13, but just exclude that to the property owners And so, like, when I say that your house is sold, that next person pays the tax rate on what the house is sold for. And I think this way here, it'd be a saving grace for all the farmers and all the old school people who did not get their pensions and degrees and have the opportunity to go to college and, you know, and make a really good living, or as they've been wage slaves all their lives, and they have an opportunity to pass on their property, which creates generational wealth for those who are struggling. So I'd like to hear comments from you folks on that, and I think this would be a great way to get the ball rolling.
Hey, Mark, thanks a million for the call. Joanna, I like that idea just from a discussion point of view, because my reaction is that's not a conservative or a liberal proposal. I mean, that's freeze property tax rates at the level that people bought their home at so they can pass on generational wealth. And maybe you means test it for, you know, middle class and lower income Vermonters, but we can't afford it, I don't think.
Yeah, it's a really interesting concept, and I wasn't aware that California had that policy, so I really appreciate hearing about it. I mean, it's like, as a homeowner, like, I'm like, oh, that would be great. But I also feel like people come here for all different reasons. And, you know, we've got climate refugees, we've got trans refugees, we've got people who come to Vermont for all different reasons. And to me, it does functionally discriminate a bit against people who moved here versus people who are the quote unquote real Vermonters who've been here for eight generations. And you know, they lived somewhere eight generations ago too. So I just kind of feel like, you know, but they don't get to freeze their tax rate from whatever that was. So I do feel like it's a little problematic to folks who are newer Vermonters, but I completely understand the sentiment. And I think the other, like, real take home, Kevin, is what you flagged, that I don't think we can afford it because we would lose so much, you know. But it's really interesting, and it does reframe the debate a little bit. I really appreciate the comment.
Now, so sticking with property taxes, I noticed that Emily Kornheiser, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee in Montpelier, is rolling out a new education finance property tax plan. I have not read it, but it is pretty clear to me that we are seeing the beginning, and I'm old enough to remember this is going to be probably the fourth massive debate around property taxes and education that I've seen. We're headed for another major overhaul of how we pay for education, and it's going to be a doozy, and Kornheiser is going to be right there in the middle.
Yeah. You know, want to hear something funny? When I was in the Maxwell School, we studied Vermont's centralized school financing system as like a sort of like held up as a progressive model. And I always thought it was so great. And I have to say, like, now I see it's super complicated and doesn't necessarily stand up to the test of time, even though the good sentiment is there. All I know about Emily Kornheiser's plan is it has to do with the state education fund providing a base payment to districts by student, per student. And that's the baseline, and then districts could raise money above that, which I think is what New York does. I would have to look back, but I'm pretty sure that that is common in other states. It does seem like it's moving fast and needs to be vetted a little more. I'm curious about that. And I also am curious about how it would affect a lot of other things we do in the name of equity, like the per pupil weighting system. Like, does that hose out all the weighting because that was established for a reason? And I'm just really curious about getting more into the details. I don't think they could possibly work that out this session, but, you know, I could be wrong. It's happened.
Yeah, it's just a massive. I was there for the Act 60 debate, and I was talking to the godfather of that, the intellectual godfather, Paul Cillo, who was the House member from Hardwick, who lost his seat over this fight. And the problem politically, it always seems to me, and I don't take credit for inventing this, but somebody told me, nobody wins when you redo the education funding formula. Everyone's angry about it. You know, back in the Act 60 days, the wealthier ski towns were angry. You know, taxpayers are angry. Just the mere fact that we're talking about it gets people angry. So I'm just not sure, you know, where's the political leverage? And I, you know, it takes, and we everyone complained about Republican and Democratic governors, Howard Dean, Jim Douglas. Why won't you use your political capital to drive home something that reduces people's property taxes? And the problem is you got to pay for these schools. So I'm not sure where it's going to go, but it's not going to happen this year, right? It's going to happen next year.
I would think. I can't imagine that they would be able to get it done this year. It's just going to be too. They've got to get community input, or people, like you're saying, like people are going to be mad no matter what, but they have to take more input.
Yeah. We have a call from Rich in Starksboro, who is a regular caller. Welcome back to the show, Rich.
Oh, thank you. I got a question for you and your guest, and hopefully one of you can answer it. I read in a news article where a one-term House member is not going to return because of the economics and, you know, compensation. And the person said that the allowance for housing and the allowance for meals is taxable. And if someone's in a fairly high income bracket and it's not taxable, that's a fairly good perk. Can you confirm or not whether that's taxable or not?
Oh, boy, I don't know the answer. You know, you are – thanks for the call, Rich. You're raising a great issue. So – and I know Emma Mulvaney-Stanek, the new mayor of Burlington, who just resigned her House seat, has long complained about the lack of pay. Legislators complain about it all the time. They don't do it publicly because they don't want to lose favor with their constituents. But behind the scenes, they really complain about how much it costs them to serve. Whether it's taxable, I don't know the answer. I am going to guess that it is. And that would serve, that would give them another point of complaint. Joanna, I don't know. Do you know the answer to that?
I'm not sure either, but I do, that does sound right to me. I do think it is taxable. And the base pay for legislators, you know, it's considered a part-time job. So, you know, even though it's not, like any legislator would tell you, this is not a part-time job. But it's, you know, it's paid by the state as if it's a part-time job, and many people really can't afford to either give up their existing career or, you know, there's so many permutations that make it, it bothers me when people call it a citizen legislature because it's not, I don't think only citizens can afford it. Like anybody would have trouble affording that kind of work.
Yeah. No, it's right. It's about $500 a week. And, you know, the truth is, to some Vermonters, that's real money. I mean, that is, you know, they're saying, what's the problem?
Right.
The problem is, if you're Emma Mulvaney-Stanek and you have two children and you want to do public service and you got to get in the car and drive to Burlington every day all winter,
right,
leaving your two kids in, you know, childcare that is hard to get and hard to pay for, it's a real problem. And so,
right.
I don't know. We're getting into the whole issue of, do you expand the state house? Do you pay the legislature more money? Do you ask them to serve less? I must say, I kind of like the idea of shortening the legislative session by a month, which allows people to work at their regular job more, but I don't know. That takes a lot of study.
Well, that is one of the challenges, is that it's hard for a lot of them to, like, maintain another job to, you know, fill up their income to pay for their house, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, the model of, you know, we put the Capitol in Montpelier because it was in the center, and we've, you know, and we did it in the wintertime so that the farmers could serve in the legislature. The phones are lighting up, Joanna. You're attracting everybody. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. Listen, I want to, on the property tax, the school education tax, I just want to put forth the proposal that our current system actually worked as it was designed to do. And people did react and did vote down some budgets and did put a great deal of downward pressure on the statewide property tax, although there was still a big increase. But this education tax has always been backed up by the possibility that they can reduce our property tax and that income sensitivity level immediately by when they put out the budget, they put in more money from the general fund, et cetera, if they want to really try to ease off on the property tax. So, you know, the education fund worked as it was designed to do, despite what people say. And the unfortunate side of any talks that they're doing right now, they all tend to give more and more control to Montpelier over the schools. So, you know, that's what I'm seeing and hearing.
Okay. Rama, always for the call. And to round out the all-star cast of callers, we're going to go next to the pride of Elmore Mountain. Rusty, you're on the show. What do you got?
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
I'm pretty good.
Rusty.
Welcome.
Hi, Joanna. I like your tone on this radio show, Joanna. Very nice.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, mental health. Kevin, you know me as a man of frivolity, but your one caller, as I do my bacon in the oven, got me thinking when she was saying I think she might have used the term sad sack about the gent that lit the thing on fire and he can't get a woman, you know. Maybe he lit that up because he couldn't find a mate. Well, I'm thinking up here at my house, maybe he lit the fire because he did find a mate, you know. I'm just thinking perception of other people. I like to walk my walk, taking my perceptions and stuffing them because they're mostly always wrong. And just in this case, I would say my observation. You can observe experience, but you can't judge what someone's experience was. On this one, I would say mental illness is very nuanced and complicated. Yeah. And it's really at least curious to hear when someone gets on and has it all down pat, you know. So that's my thought on that. And I'll leave you to the rainy Friday, and it's looking good up here in Elmore. Good show, as always.
Thanks a lot. Boy, what a great reminder. You're right. Speculation's good and fun, but mental illness is complex, delicate, and tricky, right?
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate that flag. Mental illness and even just, you know, people are troubled in all kinds of ways, and we just have no idea what's going on with this guy. It's true.
Yeah. I do want to come back on another show, though, to young men, because it's a thing, and they're getting left behind in lots of ways, school. Mm. And I think the phone and the internet is playing a large part. The books are coming out all about loneliness. And these young white men they're doing the school shootings overwhelmingly. And we have to grapple with that, I think, as a society. So these school shootings are not being done. These incidents are not happening at the hands of young women. They're happening at the hands of young men. And we have to figure out why.
Yeah, that's true. That's definitely the trend.
Yeah. Okay. We're now going to take another break. We're going to come back. We're going to ask Joanna Grossman to stick with us for another 15 minutes or so, because you may be expecting our Washington correspondent, Bob Ney, but he is off today. So you've got Joanna and me for another 15 minutes. We continue to take your calls, and we're reviewing the week's news. 244-1777. I'm Kevin Ellis, and it's Vermont Viewpoint, and you're listening to WDEV.